Fundamentalists Respond to Modernism, the seventh talk in a series on Christianity in America, was presented by Tim McIntosh on May 8, 2013, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Is week 7 out of 10. We are on the downward slope of this class. This is a history of Christianity in the United States. Last week, week 6, was covering this huge momentous shift, this upheaval that happened after the Civil War, between the years of the Civil War, the end of the Civil War, and the 20th century. Today is going to discuss that exact same time period, because last week we talked about one theological reaction to the upheaval. Today we're going to talk about a different theological reaction to the upheaval. So let's first talk about what the upheaval was. We'll review what the first reaction to it was, or the reaction that we discussed last week, and then we'll discuss for the majority of today's class. Sorry, my keys are stabbing me. I need to take them out of my pocket. We'll discuss the second theological response to the upheaval of the late 19th century. So, what was the upheaval? I talked mainly about three things. The first big change is the United States undergoes a massive industrial revolution. Britain had gone through an industrial revolution, and on its heels, factories moved to the United States. And the effect, basically in one generation, is that America shifts from an agrarian populace to an industrial populace in a very, very short amount of time. So it's hard. I don't have time to go through all of the ways in which that would change your life. And I don't mean to imply that the farming life is somehow an easy life. It's certainly a difficult life. But imagine that when you wake up in the morning for, you know, the first 30 years of your life, you have woken up because the sun is beaming in through your farmhouse and it's time to get up. And this is the season in which we plant the seeds and we till the ground. Imagine shifting from that to city life, where basically your life becomes automated in some ways. You show up for work when the factory whistle blows. You wake up when your alarm clock goes off. You work your 12-hour shift and you come home after the factory whistle blows. You're coming home to a very densely populated living room that you share with your wife and your two kids and maybe another family also. That's how dense and crowded things are. That's how radical the shift is between this agrarian life and the industrial life. Also during this time, there is a population explosion in the United States. An absolute explosion. One of the things we mentioned last week is that in this population explosion, there's a massive influx of Catholics from Ireland. Why is this significant? Because up until this time, the United States has been largely Protestant. Maryland is a little bit of an outlier. They're friendly with Catholicism, but for the most part, we're Protestants. Catholics come in and it starts all sorts of social disruption. I didn't mention it last week, but I think I've got a little time to do this. Are you guys familiar with the founding of Central Park in New York City? Have you ever heard about the story of the founding of Central Park? I'll tell it in brief. There's an opera house in the middle of the 1800s that is built in downtown New York City. Their first play that they're going to put on, I believe, is Hamlet. Ugh, I believe it's Hamlet. Don't quote me on that one, though. But a major famous Shakespearean play, whichever it was. New York City has got a huge Irish neighborhood and a huge Italian neighborhood. And all the Irish want their guy to play Hamlet. And all the Italians want their guy to play Hamlet. The opera house chooses, I believe, the Italian, and the Irish go crazy. Okay, boy, I'm really fuzzy on this. One of the neighborhoods won. The other neighborhood is so angry that opening night they march on the opera house. The National Guard has been called out because they're anticipating there's going to be a ruckus. One of the National Guardmen lowers his rifle into the crowd and shoots. Then some more rifles go off. It ends up that six people end up being killed, and they've got a major race riot on their hands. Now, a lot of the wealthy people in New York City say, this is not an acceptable situation. We need to do something about for these people because look at their plight. They're living in these super dense neighborhoods. They're working these factory jobs. This is a terrible situation. I know what we're going to do. We're going to open up public libraries. We're going to open up museums. We are also going to create a huge green space in the middle of New York City, and we're going to make it the most beautiful garden you can imagine, a garden of democracy where the rich and the poor can mingle together. That's kind of how Central Park gets started. And it's in so many ways, it's emblematic of the kind of terror of the times. There's all this unrest, not just because of changing demographics, but because of just the heat and squalor and terrible living conditions that are in cities at this time. Last major change, in addition to industrialization and immigration, is big intellectual theories, discoveries. Namely, for our purposes, Darwin's theory of evolution is published during the American Civil War, and it's kind of a ticking time bomb that will explode after the Americans get done fighting their Civil War. There's also the growing influence in churches and in American seminaries of higher criticism. The higher critics don't read the Bible as a faithful testimony of what God has done for his people. Instead, it's kind of a group diary of what the Jews believed about what was happening to them spiritually. It was written many years after the actual events took place, and it's kind of like the writers looking back 500 years earlier and saying, boy, what happened at the Exodus when we came out of Egypt, it was almost supernatural. It was as if like a pillar of fire led us, a pillar of smoke in the daytime. So that's kind of the way that higher critics looked at the Bible. It's not a faithful testimony of God's interaction with his people. It's just one particular group of people's kind of religious imagination or their religious diary. So the modernists are a theological response that happens at this time. And they look at all these different changes and they say, change is good. Let's go for it. Industrialization is bringing all sorts of problems and we need to deal with those problems. But the basic intellectual movements of the time are things that we need to grasp onto, and we need to change the way that we think about Christianity. Christianity needs to be updated. It needs to be modernized, thus the term modernist. Sometimes I'll call them liberals, but I like the term modernist better because within the very name is you hear the impulse toward what they want to do with Christianity. They want to modernize Christianity. The three beliefs of the modernists that I wanted to emphasize last week are the first I've already mentioned, the conscious adaptation of religious ideas to modern culture. Science paves the way for this. Thus, the modernists are going to be very skeptical of miracles. If science is the way that we understand knowledge, science shows us that we don't see resurrections every day. So the modernists are going to be really skeptical about the miracles. They also emphasize an inner religious experience. That's the core of true religion. It's not creeds. It's not the scriptures, but it's my own personal intuition of the way that God is interacting with me. They're taking this from a guy named Friedrich Schleiermacher, who's a German living in the mid to late 1700s, Jack? 1800s. 1800s. Okay. And the third major aspect of the modernist movement is an adherence to social activism, the social gospel. Their hope is that all of society becomes, in essence, sort of baptized by the movement of the Spirit. All of society is brought in conformity with the teachings of Jesus. Now, keep in mind, this is interesting and important. The modernists don't object to the teachings of Jesus so long as he's not talking about his own resurrection. They like the Sermon on the Mount, for example. That's great stuff. But all that kind of supernatural stuff, Jesus feeding the 5,000, not very important to them. In fact, probably didn't happen. That's religious imaginations that came later. Okay? So the modernists want to bring society into conformity with the teachings of Jesus, but they're not wild about a lot of the things of Jesus that are flecked with supernaturalism. Does that make sense? I'm going to spend the last part of class talking about the social gospel because it's the most complicated thing in this discussion, and it's kind of here with us in the present. You all probably see there's a relationship between the social gospel and kind of liberal politics today. It's not how it started, but that's where it's kind of ended up. So I'll talk about that in the last maybe third of class. So I've organized this week into two major challenges. The whole class has kind of been organized around challenges. When Christians in the United States face this challenge, what do they do? The two challenges this week are, is Christianity modern? Last week, the modernists said, yes, it is. We need to modernize. Let's get to it. Today, the fundamentalists are going to pose a different response. No, let's not modernize Christianity, because if we modernize Christianity in the way that you guys want to modernize it, it's not really Christianity anymore. Let's be serious about this. So that's going to be the modernist response. Is Christianity modern? The modernists say yes. The fundamentalists will say no. Second question, should Christians fight for social justice? The modernists will say yes. The fundamentalists will say no. But we'll go into greater detail about that the last third of class. So who are the fundamentalists? I think the most helpful way to think about the fundamentalists is this. Imagine an immigrant who has brought his family to another country, and he has been practicing within his family some of the traditions, keeping the values, the important stuff from his homeland. But he realizes that the whole culture around him has changed really radically from his homeland. And what he's hoping to do is preserve those maybe institutions and traditions and values that he thinks are so essential to his family. He's trying to preserve those while the rest of culture is leaving him, is just going in a bad direction. And that's the best way to think about fundamentalism. There's a little problem with my analogy, though. It sounds like it's just a sociological or just a kind of like familial decision. I don't want my family to change. And so I don't want you to be fooled and think that fundamentalism at its beginning was not a theological movement. Because at its beginning, it's a theological movement and it's very intellectual. It's really, really sharp at the beginning. And then it becomes kind of a social religious movement later. And I'll talk about how it becomes that in the middle part of class. So fundamentalists at the beginning are theologians who see the kind of drift toward modernism that's happening in churches and in seminaries, and they don't like it. They think that the modernists are throwing out key essential aspects of Christianity. So in 1876, there's an evangelical named David Swing who becomes a modernist. He is brought up on heresy trials by an evangelical, but David Swing wins his heresy trial. So it's sort of a shot across the bow to conservatives that, you know what? You might not win this little battle that's just starting. We, the modernists, might win. David Swing won his heresy trial. There's another shot across the bow. In 1892, the modernists in the Presbyterian denomination begin clamoring for changing the Westminster Confession. Do you guys know what the Westminster Confession is? So it's that long creedal document that the English, they call them the English divines, the English reformers come up with. It's basically a statement of Reformation belief. In 1892, the modernists are like, can we change some things in there? Let's alter some of the Westminster Confession. And so there's another shot across the bow. The modernists want to change the kind of the core creed of the Reformation movement. So, in response to this, I'm calling them the evangelicals, the fundamentalists begin publishing a series of pamphlets. There's about 64 different theologians who begin writing responses to the modernists. They begin publishing these things. Okay? Many of these early pamphlets are written and they're coming out of a particular school, the Princeton School of Theology. These are some sharp guys that are writing these things. The names Archibald Alexander, Charles Hodge, B.B. Warfield, they began the Princeton School of Theology. And later writers like J. Gresham Machen will go to the Princeton School of Theology, and they're writing these pretty powerful pamphlets against the modernists. Their focus especially was aimed at thwarting the attack of the modernists upon the scriptures. So the fundamentalists argue that in the original autographs of the scriptures, they are inerrant, free of error of any kind. Furthermore, they also talk about the way that the scriptural authors were inspired. And they have one view, and that's plenary inspiration. Do you guys know what plenary inspiration is? Familiar with that? Basically, God spoke, they wrote. As opposed to something like God shaped every aspect of Paul the Apostle's existence in such a way that he was prepared, equipped, educated to actually write down the scriptures. They took it another step further. It's like a dictation method. Okay, so they have a very, very high view of the scriptures because their argument is, look, if we show that the scriptures are inerrant, trustworthy, inspired, then the modernists can't just do whatever they want to do with the scriptures. They have to take the scriptures seriously, okay? So, the fundamentalist begins as a kind of theological movement that grows out of the Princeton School. It becomes wed with a different kind of theological movement that's much more populist and that has a different sort of theological conviction. These are the dispensationalists. You guys know the dispensationalists? Familiar roughly? I'll just tell you where they got their name. They had a view that God works in different ways in different eras of history, meaning there are dispensations of God's will upon different eras of history. So I'm going to use the board. Those of you who are watching at home, hang on for one second. So Adam, the time of Adam, God worked in a particular way with Adam. And then Moses comes along, and God works in a different way. This is the era or the dispensation of the law. And then later, when Christ comes along, God is dealing with his people in a different way, and that is through grace. That's the dispensation of grace. Now, I'm not including. There are, I think, maybe five or seven major dispensations, depending on seven, is that right? Depending on who you ask. But they get their name by this idea that God is working in different ways with different people in different eras. What's most interesting for our purposes is that they are a populist movement, meaning American, if you've paid attention to this class, you've seen that there are a series of evangelical preachers that come forward in American history, like George Whitefield, John Wesley, Charles Finney, and they have this capacity to speak to huge groups of people, really powerful orators, and they're oftentimes, most of the time, they're evangelists, and the dispensationalists are kind of heirs to that impulse in American Christianity. So there's a guy named Dwight L. Moody. Dwight L. Moody is born middle part of the 1800s, and he becomes the most famous, most popular Christian evangelist of the day, speaking to 12 to 20,000 people at a time, speaking in cities. He's from Chicago. He speaks in Boston. He speaks in San Francisco. He speaks all over the place. So the dispensationalists are, there's a theological strain to them. There's also a populist strain to them. And the third kind of like major ingredient to the dispensationalists, there is a deeply pessimistic strain to the dispensationalists. So the modernists, they're happy. They're optimistic. Things are going to go great if we can reform society in the right way. The dispensationalists are like, no. The world is going to hell in a handbasket. Christian civilization is doomed. I have a little, I have two graphics. That's one. Here's the other one. There's a great book, if you're interested in the subject. It's by George Marsden. He's an evangelical historian who wrote this book. It's called Fundamentalism in American Culture. The cover of it, hopefully you can see it. It says so much about what's going on with the fundamentalists. Can you guys see this? This is the front cover of his book. So Christian civilization is the top. It's kind of the roof of the building. There are two pillars supporting it. One of them is church. One of them is school. And there's a strong man. He almost looks like an evil Samson, labeled modernist. And his two legs are labeled Darwinism and denial of the Bible. And this strong Samson is pulling down the two pillars that Christian civilization sits on. He's pulling churches down. He's pulling schools down. So there are these two strains to the fundamentalist movement. One of them is intellectual, very biblical, or attempting to be very biblical. The other one is populist, pessimistic, with a different sort of theological strain to it. And what happens is, during the late 1800s and the early part of the 20th century, groups from these two camps get together during summer Bible conferences. And there are theologians sitting around in tents kind of like hammering out what pamphlets they're going to write against the modernists and what they're kind of like the key beliefs to their movement are going to be. So they kind of get squashed into one, even though in a lot of ways they don't really belong together. There are some ways in which they just can't be bedfellows for very long. But they're united in being against the modernist movement. Okay. One more thing about the dispensationalists. When I'm talking about their pessimism, Dwight L. Moody is different from the other great revival preachers that came before him in American history in this way. He separates social action from his evangelistic preaching. He's very sour on social action. So there's this famous quote by Moody. He says, when I used to preach, when I preached as a young man, I would carry a Bible in my right hand and a loaf of bread in my left. But I stopped carrying the loaf of bread. Why? Because a loaf of bread only feeds a person for the day, but the scriptures feed the soul for eternity. So he separates these two things in a way that have never really been separated. They weren't separated for George Whitefield. George Whitefield is raising money for his orphanage, you know. Charles Finney, you might not like Charles Finney's theology that much, but he's all about reform, social movement, and the abolitionist movement, the anti-slavery movement, really has a lot of its roots in the social activism, I think I'll call it social activism, of the Second Great Awakening. But that will kind of stop with the fundamentalists. I'll detail kind of the reasons why in a second. Okay. I'm going to talk about two other fundamentalists, popular fundamentalists, in addition to Dwight Moody. One of them, I'm just going to admit, it's just strictly for color's sake. Have you ever heard of Billy Sunday? Okay, so I just got to talk about Billy Sunday for a second, because Billy Sunday for me kind of represents the kind of embarrassing part of the fundamentalist kind of like popularism. Billy Sunday was a professional baseball player. Didn't have a terribly successful career, and he gets out of baseball, and he becomes a Christian. And he had a knack for preaching and entertaining huge crowds, and he would sometimes set up a home plate in the middle of his revival stages, and he would be off stage, you know, outside of the tent, and there'd be these huge crowds just dying to hear Billy Sunday preach. And he would begin his whole sermon by, you know, there'd be sawdust around the plate. He'd rush in from outside the tent, and he'd slide into home, and he'd get up and dust off, and he would say, the umpire may have called me out, but Jesus says I'm safe, you know, and people would go crazy, and then he would preach. He was not what you would call theologically savvy. He would occasionally be pressed in interviews to kind of like explain his theological beliefs, and he would oftentimes just answer, "I'm sorry, that's just too deep for me," or "I'm just going to have to pass on that one." And he said one time, kind of instructively, "I don't know any more about theology than a jackrabbit does about ping pong, but I know that I'm on my way to glory." So we have fallen a long way since the time of George Whitfield's open air preaching, which was, if you read his sermons, or even Jonathan Edwards, their open air preaching is pretty profound. It's meaty stuff. It's strong, packed with real theology. It seems like Billy Sunday is not, Christianity in some ways is a vehicle for rallying the conservative classes, the people who are kind of very, very worried about what's going on in the United States. He is also, Billy Sunday, deeply skeptical of the growing threat from Europe. So he preaches into the kind of early part of the 20th century. He even preaches into World War I. Here are a couple of quotes that kind of reflect his patriotism. "Christianity and patriotism are synonymous terms, and hell and traitors are synonymous." During World War II, he ended one of his sermons waving the flag and saying, "If you turned hell upside down, you would find Made in Germany stamped on the bottom." Before the House of Representatives in 1918, he advised God. That's what my notes say. He advised God that the Germans were a great pack of wolfish Huns whose fangs drip with blood and gore. Okay, enough Billy Sunday. Another fundamentalist, populist, is a man named William Jennings Bryan. William Jennings Bryan was known as the Commoner. That was his nickname. Full disclosure, I went to Bryan College in Tennessee. Bryan College was set up a few months after William Jennings Bryan died. It was set up in Dayton, Tennessee, the home of the Scopes trial. We'll talk about the Scopes trial, the famous monkey trial of 1925. I was an editor on the newspaper, and the newspaper's name was The Commoner, named after William Jennings Bryan. So William Jennings Bryan was a great orator. I think he ran for president four times. He ran on the Democratic ticket, was defeated all four times. He came really close once, I believe. He is a little bit different from some of the other fundamentalists in this regard. He is not a pessimist. He is a post-millennial optimist, okay? So he's a little bit out of keeping with the dispensational strain of the fundamentalist movement, but nonetheless, he preached and wrote for the fundamentalist cause. He gave often apologetics for the Christian faith, but it's really interesting to note that his apologetics, his defenses of the Christian faith, are all based on what Christianity achieves socially, civically. And when he gets put on the stand during the Scopes trial, that's in essence what his defense of the Bible is. His defense of the Bible is that it's good for civilization and Darwinism is bad for civilization. So when Clarence Darrow presses him on certain kind of difficult passages in the Bible, he just doesn't seem prepared. That's not really what his defense is about. His defense is about upholding a civilization that he loves. Okay, here are a couple quotes from Brian. In countries where other religions and philosophies prevail, except where they have borrowed from Christianity, they have made no progress in 1,500 or 2,000 years. Another quote. Christian civilization is the greatest that the world has ever known because it rests on a conception of life that makes life one unending progress toward higher things with no limit to advancement or development. Okay, so these two schools, the Princeton Theology School and the Dispensationalist School, merge together, and there are two galvanizing events that kind of secure the name fundamentalist for the fundamentalists. The first is there's a series of 12 pamphlets published between 1910 and 1915. They were published and funded by two California oil millionaires, Milton and Lyman Stewart. They subsidized the publication of these pamphlets. They helped distribute over 3 million copies. They were free to teachers, preachers, youth leaders, and professors. And in publishing these pamphlets, the fundamentalist movement was trying to outline an unnegotiable minimum position for all Christians. There were several, at the beginning of the movement, there are lots and lots of proposals for what belongs among the fundamentals of the fundamentals. Eventually, it's all boiled down to basically there are five fundamental tenets of fundamentalism. Here they are. Number one, the inerrancy of Scripture. Number two, the virgin birth of Christ. Number three, the substitutionary atonement of Christ. Number four, the physical resurrection of Christ. Number five, the miracle-working power of Christ. Now, maybe you're asking yourself the question, why those five things? I get the physical resurrection of Christ. That seems absolutely essential. The virgin birth of Christ. Why that? Keep in mind that the fundamentalists are responding to specific perceived encroachments by the modernists. So each of these five things is responding to doctrines that the modernists attacked. That's why the five fundamentalists don't seem like, if you were to just sit down and write five short sentences of what you think just is the core message of the Bible, you probably wouldn't come up with maybe the virgin birth of Christ. You might not. But for the fundamentalists, these are written chiefly in reaction to the modernists. They're written as defenses. All five points are adopted by the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church in 1910. And all young men going into ministry had to subscribe to the five points. Okay, moving on. The second galvanizing effect, that was the first one, 1910 to 1915, the publishing of the five fundamentals. The second galvanizing effect is the Scopes trial of 1925. So John Scopes is a teacher in a Tennessee public school. And what happens is the ACLU basically wants a court case. They want to be able to allow evolution to be taught in school. So they go to John Scopes. I don't know much at all about John Scopes. I don't know why the ACLU went to him. But they go to John Scopes and they say, listen, just teach evolution in school. We know that you'll be breaking the law, but we'll get your back. We will do all of your court cases for you. We're going to get you a great lawyer. Everything's going to go great. So John Scopes goes. He preaches evolution. He's put on trial. And a huge titanic showdown happens. Clarence Darrow shows up to defend John Scopes. Clarence Darrow is this famous, super sharp lawyer. He's going to defend Scopes. And for the prosecution, William Jennings Bryan, he's going to show up and he is going to prosecute John Scopes. You probably know the results of the case. The result of the case, in short, were that William Jennings Bryan's side wins the actual court case, but in public perception loses the court case. So there's this kind of strange thing that happens that the law is held in Tennessee. You can't teach evolution, but everybody outside, especially, well, the reporting of it is that, man, Brian looked like a fool up there on the stand. He looked really bad, and he did look pretty bad up on the stand. So what happens coming out of that is that the fundamentalists have this, there's a strange thing that happens. As an overall percentage of those people who went to church on Sunday, the fundamentalists would have held the overwhelming majority. The modernists would have been in a minority. But the fundamentalists, despite being an actual popular majority in Christian circles, have the sense of being a persecuted minority. So there are two things happening at once. Popular, feeling kind of persecuted. Okay, that takes us up to 1925, the Scopes trial. The social gospel is this big question that both modernists and fundamentalists are wrestling over. Here's the background of the social gospel. So the social gospel is basically this question of, does Christianity apply just to individuals? Is it just about the soul? Is it just about individual salvation? Or is it about the social effects of the gospel? Is Christianity kind of like for the crowd? There's a man named Walter Rauschenbusch, born in 1861, and he becomes the key proponent of the social gospel movement. Rauschenbusch is raised a conservative. Even before he goes to seminary, he begins to have doubts about substitutionary atonement and the Trinity. Nonetheless, he becomes a Baptist pastor, and he moves into like one of the most awful neighborhoods in any city in the United States, Hell's Kitchen, New York City. I went to Hell's Kitchen several years ago, and I had all these, you know, like pictures of Walter Rauschenbusch, you know, like rallying the troops against industrial oppression. Hell's Kitchen now is just like, it's a great neighborhood. It's really, really nice now. It was not back in the day. He's a pastor, and he is kind of playing host to all of these men, married men, husbands, fathers, that keep coming to him, and they're saying, Walter, I am absolutely at the end of my rope. I don't know what I'm going to do. I cannot pay my bills anymore. I'm working 15-hour days. I am working Saturday, Sunday, Monday. I'm working every day of the week. I'm living in the squalor. I can't handle it anymore. I believe one of his parishioners ends up committing suicide, and Rauschenbusch is outraged. He is outraged that the conservatives are doing nothing. He's already leaning toward the modernists, but what he's really just disgusted by is the kind of individualism of the conservatives, of the fundamentalist movement. So Rauschenbusch begins publishing books. The first is called Christianity and the Social Crisis, 1907. Then Christianizing the Social Order, 1912. Then A Theology for the Social Gospel, 1917. I've read some of Rauschenbusch's books, and it's interesting because you can watch his theology sort of change and evolve over the time. When he begins writing, he's invoking the Old Testament prophets railing against the Israelites for not feeding the poor, for neglecting the needy, right? And he's like, come on. If the Old Testament prophets were railing against the Israelites and we call ourselves Christians, the Old Testament prophets would be railing against us. We need to do something about just this plight of the industrial situation. What happens is, because the fundamentalists don't like what he's about, and because the modernists do like what he's about, and because he's already got some theological convictions that are in the modernist camp, he becomes more and more and more in the modernist camp. Here's a quote from him from one of his books. "The social gospel is the old message of salvation, but enlarged and intensified. The individualistic gospel has taught us to see the sinfulness of every human heart and has inspired us with faith in the willingness and power of God to save, but it has not given us an adequate understanding of the sinfulness of the social order and its share in the sins of all individuals within it. The social gospel seeks to bring men under repentance for their collective sins and to create a more sensitive and more modern conscience." I mentioned George Marsden, the historian, earlier. I showed you the cover of his book. He and other historians have noticed this thing that happens in Christianity at this time, that traditional Christians who were out front tended to be the most reform-minded Christians until this time. It changes at this time. Now, traditional Christians tend to believe only in the private salvation. Think of the Moody quote. "Used to take a loaf of bread and a Bible, now I just take the Bible." Now they're concentrating on individual salvation. They are less concerned with the social effects of society. Okay? This is a big change that happens. So, in essence, what happens on the social question is the liberals, modernists kind of become the public party. They're concerned with the public world. And the fundamentalists become the private party. They're concerned only with what happens with me. Now, I'm making a little bit of a caricature, but I don't think it's too much of a caricature. I remember as a young man suggesting to someone in my church that I was going to go work in a soup kitchen. And he said to me, so you're a social gospeler? And I remember thinking, what is the social gospel? I don't know what you're talking about. But it was pretty deeply entrenched, at least in the South where I grew up. If you wanted to kind of like be active and do something good for people publicly, your theology was probably messed up. I mean, it took me a while to figure out what the social gospel even was. When I finally figured it out, I was like, that guy's crazy. What are you talking about? Okay. Let us wrap up. So we have 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th. We have 3 classes left. Here's the kind of program for the last 3 classes. Next week is World War I and World War II. Then we will talk about the evangelicals who come to prominence during the late 50s and early 60s. They're going to kind of come out of the fundamentalist movement. And it's probably the movement that I'm presuming you guys are probably most familiar with the evangelical movement more than kind of some of the other strains of Christianity that are prominent in the middle part of the 20th century. So we'll talk about the evangelicals. Then last week, I'll try to put a little bow on the 20th century, you know, and I'll talk about kind of the themes in Christianity and maybe kind of some possibilities for where we're headed in the future. That'll be fun because I get to speculate wildly. Okay, end of class, but let's go back to the Scopes trial.
I just wanted you to conjecture about how, since fundamentalists were such a large majority, how it was that they felt like a persecuted minority. I mean, what was going on? I guess it's a guess.
Yeah.
But it's an unusual situation.
It is an unusual situation. I don't think I can speculate all that much. At least within churches, mainline denominations are becoming increasingly modernist at the top. Not necessarily in the congregations, but among leaders. Seminaries have gotten pretty liberal/modernist, and church pastors are tending to be more modernist in the mainline denominations. And so what the fundamentalists see is that these guys are preaching this kind of modernist gospel, but all of their congregation are like, but we haven't changed. We want the regular good old-fashioned gospel. So there's this sense that like kind of like the elites in the churches, and maybe even the elites in the press, maybe even the elites in government, are more and more sympathetic with the modernist movement than the populace is. So what's really interesting is all of the, yeah, this is, don't you see the seeds for like the two political parties that are going on now? It's just all right here. I remember also as a young man driving through Atlanta, looking at all of these really beautiful churches downtown, the Baptist Church or the Presbyterian Church or the Methodist Church or the Lutheran Church. And I remember thinking, man, all of my friends don't go to churches that look like that. All of my friends go to churches that just are kind of, they're in the suburbs. They're not as beautiful and ornate. And I kind of figured out that what had happened is the mainline denominations had gone in this kind of modernist direction. All of my friends and their parents were kind of conservative ilk. They left those churches in the 20th century, and they just started their own denominations, or they rejected their denomination, and they started their own denominations, and they started their own churches, and the old denomination still owned those beautiful churches, but it was full of people that had kind of modernist beliefs, and really now it wasn't really full of people anymore because the modernists are going to lose numbers pretty drastically when everybody wakes up and says, hey, the fundamentalists are right. We're not Christians. I don't know that it's ever really that clear. I don't know if there's ever like a really a dawning among the modernists that was that clear that like, yeah, we really are not Christians anymore. There's just this gradual slide out of churches and just a regular recognition that, yeah, Christianity is just something that we did for a while, but we don't really believe that anymore. Let's go do other things. So fundamentalist churches will really grow, especially during the 70s and 80s, and modernist churches will begin to dwindle pretty significantly. Any other questions?
Kind of on a similar line, and I'm not sure if you would count most opinion polls as scientific necessarily, but yeah, when we were Catholic Church was choosing a new pope recently, a bunch of polls came out that said that American Catholics wanted a pope who was more liberal. Well, fact is, those numbers pulled all Catholics. However, when you just do 7 day a week weekly church going Catholics, yeah, then suddenly the number who want a conservative pope is in the majority.
Yeah, I believe that. I completely believe that. Makes sense. I bet you probably saw a similar sort of thing in Protestantism. Those who are like really serious, they're there every Sunday, they're showing up at Wednesday night Bible studies. I have a feeling they probably tended toward the fundamentalist camp. Yeah. Probably in the same way that like more liberal or more kind of happenstance Catholics probably do favor a more liberal pope. That makes sense to me. Any other questions? Yes. I will talk about that during the time that we talk about the evangelicals, because the evangelicals and the 60s are kind of coupled together. And so the 60s is remembered for so many things, but especially the changing in the relationships between blacks and whites. I will touch on it then, but I don't have time to do a whole class on it. When I gave this class, the first time I gave it, I had a whole class just talking about the black church, but I had to cut it out for lack of time. I'll touch on it, but it won't be a whole class. Yeah.
When I was growing up, the idea of being a fundamentalist or a modernist or a liberal or whatever never really seemed relevant. Mm. I mean, because it seemed like I was surrounded by people that had pretty much the same values. Whether you were a Christian or not, the family still seemed to have basic, similar social values. And then if you were dealing with other Christian kids, it seemed like the churches had similar values, mm-hmm. if that makes mm-hmm. sense. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden, if you haven't moved too much from where you were, now all of a sudden
you get a different label than what you had before. Before, you were just kind of in the group,
yeah.
And now you are separated out of the group and become, actually, I guess you could even say, like a fundamentalist.
Uh-huh.
Do you understand what
uh-huh,
I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
You haven't moved. I mean, I'm not going to move unless I have a good reason to move.
Right.
I mean, it just doesn't. For the values that you grew up with, both Christian values and just social values, it's like now all of a sudden, because you are somebody who doesn't want to move, or you move only if you have a good reason to move, now all of a sudden you get labeled for something else.
Yeah, yeah.
You understand?
Yeah. I remember talking with my dad, grew up in Kentucky, and I remember him telling me that this is before they had air conditioning, and he would sit, or at least his family didn't have air conditioning. And most of the people in his town didn't have air conditioning, so they would sit out in the cool of the evening on their porch, and people would come by and they'd visit with their neighbors. And he said there was just such a sense of cohesion in our neighborhood. And that sense of cohesion made it such that if I was doing something wrong in my neighbor's yard, my friend's mom would get in trouble with her. So there was this shared sense of, like, this is the way that you do life. And I remember when he told me that, I thought, boy, if I went to the Johnson's house and lit their cat on fire, I don't know that I would get in trouble with Mrs. Johnson. She'd probably send me home for my mom to, you know, spank me or whatever she did. But there's not this strong sense, I've never known this, but I know it just through my dad's memory. There's never this sense that I grew up with that we're all doing this thing together, you know. And there are a bunch of different reasons for why that's no longer the case. I mean, one of them is as simple as people don't sit on their porch because they have air conditioning now. And that literally is one of the reasons why. But I think there's other reasons why. And I think more and more people felt like they had to make a choice. They had to choose a side. They had to choose the conservatives or the liberals. And with that choice comes radically different approaches to just about everything. Parenting, politics, theology, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? The end. Thank you.